Sam Rockwell, and you're listening to Get Your Film Fix Podcast.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right. Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer, and I'm joined by Jeremy Fisk. And filling in for Lee today is Mr. Chapin Hemingway from Exterior Films Podcast. Thanks for coming on, Chapin.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Rival. He's a rival, and he's on our podcast.
Yeah.
We're always right next to each other on Podbean, too, as far as views. And
like the numbers?
Yeah, the numbers.
Yeah.
Lee been fired for the six stick? Oh, sorry.
We'll get to that.
No, that's fine. Yeah, we'll talk about Lee and the reasons perhaps for him not being here later on. But on this edition of the podcast, we're going to be checking out the new blockbuster genre mashup, Cowboys and Aliens, which is hitting theaters, directed by Jon Favreau. And then we're going to have a little game show segment where we're going to guess what Lee is going to think about Cowboys and Aliens. And then we'll kind of check back with him on the next podcast to see if any of our predictions were accurate. And we're then going to kind of merge into a discussion of development and the development of films, because Cowboys and Aliens had a very long development cycle, was in development hell for a while. And then we're going to wrap it all up with our top five genre mashup films.
It's not your lucky day, Stranger. Turn around and start walking. I said, turn around and start walking.
Jake Lonergan, turning you over to the federal marshal.
Boss, Lonergan's in town.
I want that man. You give him to me now, or I'm gonna take him.
All right, so this week we went and saw the new blockbuster genre mashup film Cowboys and Aliens in the theaters. And Jeremy, I know you had voted to see this film, particularly in the theaters, against other options like Crazy Stupid Love. Do you regret that decision? I mean, I feel like we've done a lot of blockbusters lately. Do you feel like we were maybe missing out on something else that would have been better?
Probably, yeah. I mean, as soon as the reviews came out and they, you know, didn't look so good, I was regretting not seeing Crazy Stupid Love. But I've wanted to see this movie for a while, especially since Jon Favreau is directing it, and I really like the concept of it. So it was one of those movies I think we had mentioned early on that we were going to watch for the podcast. So I thought, you know, let's just stick with it. Also, it's a big budget movie. It's going to get more viewers, so maybe we'll get some more listeners for the podcast also. That's right, we sell out here.
It was very meh, you know?
Yeah, there was nothing...
Just kind of middle of the road for me.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I don't know. Chapin, what do you think?
I agree as well. I was not at all... I disliked very little about the movie, but again, I thought it was such an interesting concept, or rather a potentially interesting concept, that a lot more could have been done with it, which was the general consensus of those who I saw it with as well. And yeah, I mean, I kind of went out of it saying, well, you know, despite a fairly original title and original concept, you know, things went pretty much according to plan, you know, like how I would have thought it they would. And I have to say I was a little disappointed by that.
Yeah, I was too. I mean, you get a concept like this. This is what, you know, we don't really see that much in blockbusters, this sort of high concept that we know going in is going to have a lot of explosions and a battle. I mean, it's sort of a dream for the studios, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But yeah, it didn't connect to me on any sort of human or emotional level, and I think that's where it went wrong. I mean, it didn't look past its own concept of cowboys fighting aliens to try and bring something where we could connect to the movie, and that's kind of sad seeing the talent that was involved.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. I think it started out decently enough. Like, I thought it established kind of Daniel Craig's character Jake Lonergan or whatever, trying to figure out what had happened to him, and I think it established that in coming to the town fairly well in the first like 10 minutes. But after that, I think we're just introduced to characters, and besides Jake Lonergan, there's almost no development within them. Very little. I mean, I guess you get a little bit with Harrison Ford, but that's really about it. And I think they're just there to do the job that you know they're going to do. And so there's really no mystery or intrigue to the rest of the film.
Well, let's talk about this as a genre piece. I mean, essentially, I think Favs had it right when he tried to make this the type of Western it was, especially in the first 20 minutes. You really saw him attempt to conjure up Westerns of the past. And I think the first 20 minutes of this movie was really, really good. And then it just lost its way. It lost its way with what it was trying to do with the plot, essentially. It lost its way what it was trying to do with all these relationships. It tried too hard to be a movie where everybody, comes together and gets along and we're in it for a greater good. And it ended up just turning into a mess, really. A mess that I was never really that bored with, but... Mm-hmm. A mess, nonetheless. I mean, what do you think? Do you guys agree?
Yeah, it wasn't so much a mess for me.
That he at least tried to do something interesting, or tried to like really focus in on that Western part of this film. I mean, I saw all these shots that harken back to Ford and the Searchers. There was one where Daniel Craig's standing out towards the end of the movie, which I thought was going to be the last shot of the movie, and I was like, oh, that's kind of brilliant, which is the last shot of the Searchers, where John Wayne's standing silhouetted by the door frame, and then he looks around, doesn't know which way to go, he's a loner, and then he walks out. And that same shot's in Cowboys and Aliens, but then they have to have this Hollywood sort of wrap-up at the end where him and Harrison Ford, hey, nice working with you too, good luck, yeah, So I think whenever he did try to inject some sort of interesting, Western motifs and Western filmmaking, he had to bring it back to this sort of cliched Hollywood right after, and that was sort of sad.
Yeah, I mean, I think visually, you're absolutely right. I think visually this film was pretty well done, and even like Favreau's credit is over a similar shot where in the beginning, a title sequence where Daniel Craig, I think, is entering that bar. He is sort of silhouetted in kind of a beautiful shot. And he did that very well. But my problems with the film wasn't so much the on the visual end, but the fact that, we have these two, and we'll get into this more later when we do our top five, but the genre mashups, it seemed to follow... In each sense, when the movie went to either a Western or a sci-fi film, followed that sort of formulaic path. You had the Indian white man relationship between Harrison Ford and the Native American actor from, I believe it was Wind Talkers. He was from that Clint Eastwood film, Flags of Our Fathers. And, that kind of wrapped up in a very cliched manner. And, I mean... I don't know. I had a problem with the fact that we have these two very interesting concepts, and they sort of went the way we would have anticipated. But I think you're right. Visually, it was actually quite brilliant.
Yeah, no,
what does
I
that
think,
mean at the end of the day?
I think we should talk about these relationships, and let's talk about if any of these relationships were developed in a way that were interesting to us, and. It almost seemed like they tried to throw too many of these relationships into the movie, where they also tried to wrap them up in a sort of swelling emotional way that just missed on a lot of occasions, almost laughable on some occasions. And they were introducing so many things with Olivia Wilde's character, what she really is, with that relationship between Harrison Ford and his, you know, faux son there. It just, everything seemed really forced, every one of those tried to put a bow on him, and it just didn't work for me. And that's where I think this movie really was a disappointment, because essentially, what do we have to relate to other than these people, I guess, really trying to go for, you know, they're really trying to do something we could relate to, like save others, and then they just took that and they made it too convenient, I think.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree too. I think, with the exception of possibly the Daniel Craig Harrison Ford relationship, although, like you mentioned at the end, they kind of wrap it up there, you kind of see exactly where all the relationships are going and exactly what's going to happen. I think with Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford, there's a little bit of mystery because they were both leaders, and yet, so they clashed every once in a while, but you never knew if that was going to blow up into like a huge fist fight or whatever. I mean, it did end up kind of following a very formulaic path in, you know, Harrison Ford rushing into the ship and everything at the end, not to, you know, spoiler alert or whatever. But I think that was the only one that had some sense of mystery to it as to what was going to go on.
Yeah, they glossed over a lot of the convenience of what happened with a lot of this movie. You talk about Harrison Ford at the end, like, why was he even there? The fact that they were tracking this alien for so long and then they just found their lair so quickly. Then where was Daniel Craig when he ended up waking up at the beginning? How was he so far away? I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that they sort of just passed over. It's like and this is another big spoiler, Olivia Wilde's character ends up first passing away. Then all of a sudden she's back because she didn't know if she could keep the body. And then at the end, when what happens to her happens, why isn't she all right again? And there's a lot of stuff that they just sort of gloss over plot-wise. And we get sometimes grief for talking about plot on movies like this too much, but I think it's a good conversation to have. It's like, why not? Why not put that little effort into those things that you could?
Absolutely. I think that's a good point. And, you know, they never really explained, again, to avoid spoilers, why the aliens were mining what they were mining.
All they had to do was say maybe it powers their ship or something like that. But they say is it's just as precious. Well, why? Why do they care?
Well, the problem, and I felt the problem was, I thought Olivia Wilde's character was actually quite interesting at the beginning, and then once you found out more and more about her, and she became more interesting. But then when she became the sort of Ellen Page, in Inception, you know,
right, the surrogate for the
character
audience.
For giving us all the answers, it started to not work as well. Now you understand why she's actually there to, you know, give us the answers and provide another translator for the guys for the Native Americans.
Why can she speak that? Yeah, seriously.
Something I'd like to ask you guys.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jeremy.
No, I was just gonna say that's a really good point about her character, because she essentially was gonna be the romance of this, but they just sort of sprinkled that in there, right. and then you find out no, she's not the romance. All she's there for is to provide information for the audience.
Exactly. And somebody was going to ask you guys. I mean, I felt like this sort of microcosm will sum up my feelings about the movie, in that they had like four or five of the hottest writers in Hollywood right now working on this movie. And I felt that one element of the movie that was ripe for potential in terms of interesting development was the idea that, you know, suddenly there are all these, you know, different factions sort of working against each other in a very Western way, in that you have the outlaws and you have the town sheriff and you have the, you know, the rich cattleman, all sort of working against each other in this town. I mean, we've seen this before, but it's an interesting plot point. And then what Cowboys and Aliens does is they introduce another element, which are these aliens who are vicious and are going to wipe everybody out. And to me, that was a really interesting idea, that everybody would have to sort of get over what they were, their initial conflict, and work together to defeat the alien. And that's what happened. I mean, that's eventually what became of it. But there really was no conflict there. It happened too easily. And I thought that was like a really, 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 really cool point that they could have delved into and made really the heart of the movie. This, like, everybody sort of got to, you know, put away everything and work together to get everything done. Oh, I forgot about the Native Americans as well.
Right.
And it all just happened too easily. It was too convenient. But like that, and I felt also that the movie sort of denied the time period. I mean, it was just sort of a Western. It was just sort of, you know, back in the day. I mean, this was like the early 1800s or something. It wasn't, you could have really defined like where that town was and the politics of the town, and then, you know, developed it that way. And it would have been a little bit more detailed and a little bit more structured. And I think that would have been a lot more interesting. Instead, it was just sort of, again, as I've said before, very formulaic in the way everybody, you know, kind of started to work together, and, you know, people started to, you know, the Harrison Ford and the Indian chief had the nod at the end when, I mean, how many times have we seen that when he, you know, when one shoots the other? And I mean, that would really bug me. Like the last minute, the aliens attacking and somebody shoots him in the head. That, I mean, how many times did that happen in this movie? Like, it was so annoying.
Well, you knew when it was going to happen if it was a main character. If it was a main character, then that alien was going to second get shot in the head. Yeah,
Harrison Ford cannot die. That's in his contract, I think.
Yeah, and he cannot die, and somebody has to steal a member of his family. Those are the two things in his contract.
Right.
My son is in there.
He's going to talk about his son or his family.
His family, his daughter, his son, his wife. Somebody has to be taken from him. I totally agree with you. And like the first thing I thought when I saw the amount of writers on this was that's not a good thing. Because when you have that many people sort of trying to get together to produce something interesting and original, usually it goes the way of formulaic, because it's hard for that many people to agree on unique, I think. And I'm not going to repeat everything you just said, Chapin, but essentially that's what happened. That's what we got out of this was that formulaic, you know, relationships between dynamics that could have been really interesting. And the other thing is, are big budget movies like this that need to make their money back going to spend the time on those sort of political ideas, or are they going to just quickly, as they did it in this movie, resolve, show the conflict, and then immediately resolve the conflict without any real reasoning that makes sense on a sort of human emotional level, other than now there's aliens, now we must get along, let's do it. So, yeah, I think part of it was too many cooks in the kitchen, and the other part of it was this is a movie that needs to make money. We can't spend too much time worrying about how all these people are, how all these relationships change over the course of this movie. And, you know, the movie's worse off for that, unfortunately.
Yep. All right. And this is kind of off topic, but did you guys notice a few like similarities with Indiana Jones in this movie at all, or was that just me?
Harrison Ford.
Not just Harrison Ford, but, well, I mean, I'm thinking the fact that Daniel Craig, like, always hangs onto his hat. Like, even when they're running out at the end and, like, stuff's blown up behind him,
totally.
He drops it.
I absolutely
And then, like, he has to
that.
Pick it up.
Absolutely.
And
that was a very Indiana Jones moment right there.
But that's, there's nothing wrong with those little moments, I don't think. I think those are fun, you know?
No. No, that was fun. And then there's also one with one of the aliens when, like, the I don't know, I guess to call him, like, the scientist one, although not really. When he dies, he's pushed into that liquid material that kind of burns his face, and it almost looks like his face is melting. I don't know if anyone else noticed that either,
right.
But I don't know. I kind of took that as, like, two little nods to Indiana Jones, and I don't know if I was the only one who noticed.
I'm sure they're in there. To wrap this up, I had an interesting experience after the movie was over. So the movie was over. I was with it was me, Kevin, and Sarah. So we stood up And we kind of, like, we stretched, and then I, like, look over to Kevin, and Kevin goes, hey, how's it going, to somebody behind him. And we're at Dedham. We're at the what's that place called, Brantley?
Legacy Place Cinema?
Yeah, we're at Legacy Place Cinema in Dedham, and Kevin goes to somebody behind us, hey, how you doing? And I just assumed, you know, we're in Dedham, probably somebody he knew from, like, high school or, you know, his hometown or something. And then I look up, and it's freaking Steven Tyler is right behind me.
No way.
Really?
Yeah, it was the most bizarre thing because, like, the last person I expect to see sitting directly behind me is Steven Tyler. And I'm like, what is it? And then, like, without even knowing it, I'm like, I say, I'm 2 feet away from the guy, and without even knowing it, I go, is that real? Like he's not even a person. Is that thing real?
Like he's a wax sculpture?
Yeah, like he's a wax sculpture of Steven Tyler that happened to be at the movies and is moving.
just sitting in the movie, they just place him in there.
Yeah, that
just
was...
Some people think he's there in theater.
That was my reaction to Steven Tyler being behind me, was, is that real? And, I mean, he had to have heard me. I'm right next to him. But anyhow, I thought that was bizarre. All right, so since Chapin is filling in for Lee this week, we have the game show of what is Lee going to think of this movie. So he said he would see Cowboys and Aliens, so whoever gets closest will win nothing. So let's start with you, Brantley. What will Lee think of this movie?
I think he's going to kind of be in the same boat with us. I think he's not going to like it. I think he's going to find it disappointing, and I think he's going to kind of chalk it up to, like, another terrible blockbuster in what he feels like is a terrible year so far.
Terrible. So you think he's going to think it's terrible?
Well, I mean, not terrible. Like, he's just not – he's going to find it disappointing and not very good.
Yeah, I think
I
at this
but
point –
sorry, I was just going to say, I think it's going to just affirm his belief that the year so far has been terrible.
He's going to find it mediocre at best, and then essentially that is going to turn into, by the end of the year, this movie is horrible. That's where it's going to go. So it's going to be like, yeah, I agree with you guys, not very good. And then when we start talking about the end of the year and the worst movies, Cowboys and Aliens will get a nod from Lee. Chapin, you're
gotcha.
Up.
Yeah, I think Lee's gonna go, it was all right. That's what he's gonna say. And I think he's gonna just think it's mediocre as well. Lee has a tendency, like, when he'll really get into things that he probably shouldn't. Cemetery Junction.
Yeah.
Because he is wrapped up in the passion of it, or, you know, he feels really, you know, kind of falls in love with the movie. And I don't think there's anything here to fall in love with. You know, not that it's bad, but just the fact that it's kind of, you know.
Right.
You know, it's not really anything strong. So he's not going to latch on to anything. So he's going to think it's all right.
All right. Well, that's we're pretty much all even on that. So that's a pretty boring game show. All right.
But I want to say I thought Lee was like I thought he was off the podcast permanently because he made the egregious mistake of thinking the sick stick conveniently made someone throw up just because they hit him in the throat.
How wrong was he on that? Like, why do you call it a sick?
Oh my god!
Stick?
I mean, he's the one that called it a sick stick. I mean,
yeah,
come on.
That's what it's called. And just because it
that's
got
what
him
it's
in
called,
the throat
but he said that.
Why don't they call it a taser then? If it was just a taser that happened to make somebody throw up, if you get him in the throat, how does his mind work?
Right.
Sometimes
wrong. Jesus. Okay, so Cowboys and Aliens was a film that I think was developed simultaneously with the graphic novel in to be a movie and a graphic novel simultaneously, but because the movie version was trapped in what they call development hell, and maybe we can sort of elaborate on that a little bit later, the comic book was released, and then much later, the film, once it got out of development hell, was came out. As we know, we've just seen it. So I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, what development is like. Jeremy and I, we've both worked in Brantley. I don't know if you've ever done any development work, but it's an interesting part of the film industry, and it's certainly people have divisive opinions about it, and clearly it can either have a good or bad effect, as we've just outlined.
No, the most annoying part about development, and like we sort of got a sense of this when we used to intern at Walden Media, who did the Chronicles of Narnia, and there was one particular thing that probably in my opinion, the best material they had that they owned was a book called The Giver. Is a book called The Giver, and how many years ago is this? That'd been like 8 years ago now, and this movie still hasn't been made. And it's, you know, it's a pretty famous children's novel, and it's an amazing novel. But the thing about development is, there's one person, one or two people that aren't like creatively minded that have the deciding power on a lot of these movies. And what it comes down to is really, it comes down to a weird sort of pedigree, like who's the writer on it, who can we get for rewrites, it's this weird sort of thing where it's not about the material and making necessarily the best thing. It's about who are we going to get involved in this to get it to a point where they feel like they've done the most to say, yeah, let's greenlight this. And doing the most does not necessarily favor the material itself. Does that make any sense? Am I wording that correctly?
I think you're making sense. But Jeremy, before you go on, I think you should preface what you're saying by explaining to the audience that, you know, Hollywood and obviously Boston as well with Walden is ripe with these. I mean, it's full of these places, these companies that are quote unquote development companies, and either they're wrapped around a certain producer. Like I worked for Kennedy Marshall, for example, and they are just very powerful producers who set up their own shop, and you know, projects come in and they develop them and hopefully produce them. But there's tons and tons and tons of these little production companies that develop, take properties and try to make movies out of them. And Walden is a little bit different because they actually pay for their own movies and distribute them. But there are so many of these companies that this is a huge part of the industry.
It is.
Sorry, I just wanted to.
No, that's a good point, because like you watch a movie, and then there's all these different like little production companies that you see in association with, and these production companies are the production companies that help do the development. Even on the movie I'm working on now, there's about four production companies that, you know, some of them the stars own, some of them have connections to the original material. In my case, it's a comic or a graphic novel, I believe. And they all sort of, I don't know, this is just a sense I get from being sort of, from watching it sort of from a little bit of an outsider perspective, but being there, you know, close enough that I can see it, is that they all sort of hire a lot of people to try and pretend they're busy while they're pretending to try and develop a script and get some sort of material out to a big production company that has the money that's going to be able to say, yeah, okay, I want a green light that. And I don't know, I just feel like this whole thing could be streamlined a lot better, but then a lot of people also, I think, would be out of jobs. Because you just, like, think about, Chapin, you think about Walden and all the people that were hired there as, like, writers and, you know, I don't even essentially know what most of them were doing, to be honest with you. And
right.
I don't think they were necessarily, like, if they wanted to get The Giver done, okay, you get a good writer, and the writer presents a script to you, and if you like it, you say, go. You don't need, like, 17 other people that have these ancillary jobs to say what to do whatever they're doing, and that's part of development. I think it clogs up the system, and that's why we don't get as many good summer blockbusters, or part of the reason.
And I would also add that they do it in the wrong order. Like, if you remember, and Jeremy, you and I talked about this on one of our podcasts. We sort of fell in love with The Giver. I mean, we both loved it, and then we read the scripts, and they were terrible.
Yeah.
And the Walden knew they were terrible, but they still had a star attached. I mean, they buy the property, or rather, they buy the rights to the property for a certain amount of time, and they get a star attached based on the pedigree of the material or the property, and then they develop a script. And that seems like the wrong way to go, because you're trying to push through production. I mean, the idea is to get whoever's working on it is to get this movie made. And you need a star attached to get it made, regardless of, or you need something. And if the property isn't strong enough, like The Giver, I don't think probably would be strong enough. It doesn't have a big enough name. They had to get someone who, like Jeff Bridges, attached as The Giver, which was probably the wrong choice. I mean, he probably would not have been the right person for that role.
I think he's still attached to it.
Despite his talent. Is he?
Yeah, I think so.
And I would agree that there's a lot of waste. I mean, I worked at this company, Kennedy Marshall. They're like the biggest producers in Hollywood. I mean, they worked at Amblin with Spielberg in the 80s, and I mean, they're insanely wealthy and insanely powerful. And they're, these projects would come in and nothing would happen to them. And people would like were just sitting there working their, sort of 9 to 5s every day, trying to get these things developed, or maybe not even trying. Maybe you're right, Jeremy. Maybe they are just there to sustain their job. But it's a strange process, because you see I saw most of the time the wrong things being made. Like, here's a good script. Like, let's make this movie. And I remember I was an intern there when, Jeremy, you and I were in L.A., and I was there for about 6 months, and I would read scripts and write coverage, which is just a sort of a short review of a script so that, big producer can go in and say, okay, well, this sounds interesting or this doesn't, and you summarize the plot of the movie.
Do you think anyone really...
And the one script...
No, I was just going to say, do you think anyone really cares about coverage? Do they think they actually take into consideration
your
coverage?
I don't know.
Who knows
if anybody even... I wondered if... That was my question. Like, I would spend a long time, writing this stuff, this detailed coverage, and I would never hear anything from anybody, whether it was good or bad. I mean, I think that happened. Jeremy, you and I had the meeting with the VP on about The Giver, which was kind of interesting because we were so passionate about it. But my point about being at Kennedy Marshall was that, I read two good scripts out of the entire time I was there. In 6 months, one of them was about this. What are those dogs called that would go up in the Alps with like liquor around their necks and
Saint Bernards
rescue people? What are those called? Bernese Mountain Dogs.
Saint Bernard.
Exact. Saint Bernards. Sorry, Saint Bernards got their name because they from this monastery in the Alps, and it was all about how sort of Saint Bernards became these rescue dogs, and it was a really great sort of family movie. And I think the reason it came to Kennedy Marshall is because Frank Marshall directed that movie Eight Below, and about the sled dogs, and that movie did really well. And, he sort of saw all these sort of dog projects came in, but that was actually quite a good one. And the other one I read was this like fascinating Western that was about this like flood that came to this town, and it brought like these like, outlaws, and it was a great script. And I went into the guy I worked for. I was like, man, this is an amazing script. He's like, yeah, DreamWorks owns it. So why am I reading it? It didn't make any sense. Like, this is the only good script I read somebody had owned, and it has not been made into a movie yet. So it's just things like that. You just get so frustrated because you read the only good things that come in are not being made, or somebody else owns them and they're not making them, or blah, blah, blah. And it just doesn't make any sense. I think it's all about the process, and they just have it backwards, I think.
No, I was just going to say, I have a question for you guys, since I never worked in development. Do you feel like companies will buy a property just to hold on to it so another studio can't make it? Because, I mean, you hear so many times about like a book or a graphic novel being purchased, the rights to it being purchased, and then it's not made for, 10 years or whatever. Does that happen with rival companies?
I don't know for sure, but it seems that way. I mean, it seems like a lot of stuff is bought either A, to not let somebody else buy it, or B, just to have the material in your own possession. And I think that's, you know, for some reason, once they think that's done, then that's half the battle, even though if they never make it, it doesn't seem to bother them as much. But I don't know for sure, if what the reasoning is behind it.
In that you, when you buy the rights to something, you, like, for example, Walden must have paid Lois Lowry, or rather the publisher, a small amount of money relative to the total amount of money that they would have made if the movie was actually made for the rights. So you buy the rights for like a 5-year period, and then that's a relatively low amount of money, and then once the film is made, then that's when they get paid. So the ability to buy the rights to hold on to a movie is much cheaper than it is to actually make it. So that is a good point, yeah. Brantley.
And to add to Chapin's point, I don't think, you know, how everything sort of goes backwards. It still goes backwards once a movie gets greenlit. And I can say that from experience on the movie I'm working with now. I mean, we've been, like, hired onto this movie for over a month now, and things have started, and we don't start shooting till September 10th, but, you know, we got offices, we got sets starting to be built. But then the script is still constantly changing. And
right.
That's like, I mean, you should, I understand little stuff here or there, but I mean, they're changing stuff that, like, at this point, when they're building sets, these sets are not cheap, you know, and to build them, you have to have the script finalized. You can't start building a set and then the script changes and then the set changes. So they're building these sets and they have to have approval from, in this case, Universal Studios, to build the next set. So when stuff like this happens, where they have changes in the script, what it's for, I have no idea. I can only speculate whether it's the writers, whether it's a good chance it's the actor saying, you know, I want this changed or I want that changed. And then there's all these people who are trying to work and build sets that things die. You know, they just all of a sudden just, you know, there's nothing to do, and then all of a sudden it'll get ramped up again. I just think it's really weird on a movie this big that they wouldn't have this sort of stuff, especially some as complicated as movies are to make. It's relatively basic to have a script that's finalized and done and ready to go. And just to show how not finalized and ready to go the script was, I was reading it the other day, and they were trying – there's a scene we're going to shoot at Fenway Park, and they were trying to have a conversation – the characters about the Red Sox, and this was clearly written by somebody that has no idea about anything about the Red Sox. And there's a point where one of the characters goes to this guy and goes, "Hey, what is it? What was it? Like, it was 76 years since your World Series." And I'm looking at it and I'm like, "No, anyone from Boston knows it was 86 years." And like, how do these mistakes get made to a point where the script is out and sets are being built and stuff's in progress and you're messing up like basic stuff about the city you're going to shoot in? And I don't know. I think it's, you know, it's just the way movies are made. I think it's weird.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. I think as people come on to the movie and the script changes, that's definitely a bad sign. And I think probably the worst sign for a movie is when you're rebuilding sets as the script changes. If you're building a set and then you have to rebuild it because it's, or you have to tear it down because the script has changed, that's probably a bad sign.
It hasn't gotten to that point yet. It hasn't gotten to that, but it's gotten to the point where they haven't started building sets that they thought they were going to build because scripts are changing.
So last week you made it the point about Inception being, you know, the fact that it would only have been produced, it was only produced because of the clout that Christopher Nolan carries. And I thought that was a great point because, as you guys have talked about, it's sort of a bad, you know, year for movies, and nobody is really talking about any movies this summer. And Inception was such a great concept and such an interesting concept that I was sure it was going to be a hit, as it was. I mean, it didn't open huge like the studios wanted it to because it didn't carry like that sort of built-in comic book audience, but it made a lot of money eventually. I mean, it made it $300 million domestically because it was a great project that people went to see. And when my point about was that the fact that it was being talked about beyond our sort of close-knit nerdy film geek universe, like people at my work, for example, who were not very well versed in cinema, were talking about Inception and talking about how excited they were about the concept and the trailer and everything. And when that happens, that's great. But the fact that a movie like that only got made because the directors made all this money for the studio is sad, and it shouldn't be like that. People should take a look at that screenplay and say, we should make a movie like this because it's original and exciting.
And it'll make money, I hope. I mean, that's the thing.
Make money. I mean, I had I didn't think Inception was a risk at all. I thought, like, this movie's going to make money no matter what.
I mean, you got the stars it had. You had the pedigree of the director. And it's not like a little indie where you're not you don't have Zooey Deschanel in there to give it some quirk, although you did have Ellen Page. Right. But I mean, you have cities folding over each other. I mean, this is a movie that's gonna essentially follow that blockbuster formula, except for it's original and it's a new idea and it's something, you know, it's something that I guarantee you I guarantee you there are more Inception scripts out there. There are more writers with original ideas like that could bring them to life on screen and execute them well. But studios are not going to take that chance unless your name's Christopher Nolan, unless your name is James Cameron, and all you know how to do is make money.
Exactly, and unfortunately, yeah. Those writers who are writing those original scripts are being paid to rewrite Cowboys and Aliens, and they're being paid vast sums of money to do that, so it really doesn't pay to write an original screenplay anymore.
Right. So how do we fix this, guys? How do we change how do we turn the movie industry on its head?
I mean, you don't go see Captain America or
Cowboys
Thor
and Aliens
or whatever. And I told myself I wasn't going to see Thor, but yet I still did.
Right. But as filmmakers, like, what is the other option? Like, if we want to make a movie, I mean, we all have made a movie, Chapin, you more recently, and it doesn't seem there's really. I mean, it seems to me there could be this concept of making a movie for super cheap. That doesn't make a ton of money, but makes a good amount of money. And the only thing that's closest to that are horror films right now that you can almost guarantee you can make them on the cheap with no stars, and they'll at least make their money back plus more. Is it the material? I mean, if we really just had this original material that we could make for, you know, 50 grand and it was really good, it would make money? Or, you know, at our level, what's the answer?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think we can develop original ideas, but I think having the mindset that Hollywood is not set in stone, the entertainment industry is not set in stone. It moves in waves. It will cling on to something that's popular. I mean, people, you have to think of your audience and the people you're making the movie for, and that's the people who pay the tickets. It's not the studio execs who are dictating things to the audience. It's the other way around. If you write an original concept and people like it and you get it out there, then you've succeeded. And I think having the mindset that anything is possible and that you can pretty much do whatever you want if it's well done and people enjoy it, then the sky's the limit. I mean, as long as you can attract an audience, you can keep making movies, you know?
No, I was just saying, I think at our level, it boils down to just having a good story. I mean, it's that level for everything, having a good story, whether it's Hollywood or independence. But if you're going to make an independent film and you want it to succeed and make money, you really have to have a good story and good characters. Otherwise, I mean, that's just – you kind of have to go back to basics, I feel like, when it's independent films, you know? Because, you know, we don't have the resources to do really anything else. So you just have to have a good story and good characters.
And can I add to that? Quirk is not original. Quirk is not, you know, just because and it seems like a lot of independent films rely on that. And it's been happening more and more. And I'm, I I, for one, am sick of it, but that's a whole other tangent, I guess.
And I hate to beat a dead horse here, but the digital technology is just making things easier for low-budget filmmakers. I mean, I thought that Through the Woods and The Gray Area looked better than Captain America because it was shot on the Red versus the stupid Sony Genesis camera. And, we now have the ability to make a movie for $40,000 or $50,000 that looks the same as a, you know, $100 million movie. And you can even get your friends, some of my friends work in visual effects, and get them to help out on the cheap, and you can get visual effects almost as good. I mean, you know, probably not as many, but, you know, there's no reason why things can't look the same way as you've said in the past as that. I mean, the quality is there. So there really isn't any excuse to not have a story that rivals something, because it's all comes from somebody's mind. And as we've said, the great minds seem to be stuck on, you know, rewriting shit movies and bad concepts in order to sort of be the most innocuous material available. So, the field is open.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it, in a way, on the independent level, it self-regulates a little bit, just in that, just because there's so much more access to for anyone to make films, that there's so many more people in the, with zero talent and zero, you know, story ability and all this stuff making movies. So there's a lot more shit coming out, as well as those few movies that really hit because people are really passionate about their projects. So there's that too. I mean, that's, in a way, it's hurting the independent movement, because there's just, you know, we've gone to these festivals, all three of us, that, you know, you sit through these movies and you're like, you know, if it wasn't for the technology, that movie never would have gotten done. No, you know, the nobody would have put the time and effort into that, because it's just not it's just not quality enough. So there's also that downside to it.
Sometimes I worry that that's one of my movies.
Yeah, I agree. But that's for somebody else to discuss. Not your movies, but my movies.
What are we doing here?
Well, take a look. It's a goddamn hostess truck.
Yeah, I see that. A hostess truck. So what?
I could use a Twinkie.
You coming?
Yes.
Yeah. One second.
You fucking with me?
No. You should actually limber up as well. Especially if we're going down that hill. It is very important.
I don't believe in it. You ever see a lion limber up before it takes down a gazelle?
Snowballs?
Where's the fucking Twinkies?
I like snowballs.
I hate coconut. Not the taste, the consistency.
Fresh.
All right, so this week for our top five, we are doing genre mashups in honor of Cowboys and Aliens. Cowboys and Aliens are probably the most obvious genre mashup. I mean, it's right in the title. It's a Western and a sci-fi. And it gives a little more weight to the Western side, but it is one of those that has almost equal weight to both aspects of their perspective genres. So, Chapin, since you're our guest today, we'll let you start it off. Did you have any criteria?
I did. So I this is a difficult discussion I've had with the Exterior Films boys on this little vacation of ours, and I've been trying to work through these ideas, and it's been a vicious debate. My criteria was that the two elements had to be sort of equally represented, and that doesn't mean so much like Cowboys and Aliens, where it's literally in the title, but that they had to sort of hold equal weight with each other.
I agree.
And they had to be both sort of really important, and so that was what I used to dictate it. And I the I steered away from comedies because I have one comedy on there, I think, maybe two. But I thought it was a very easy. I found in my research that there would be a lot of comedies mixed with other genres, so I just tried to stray away from that.
All right, what do you got for number five?
Okay, so number five is James Cameron's True Lies. Now, this is an action slash comedy film. And the debate I had with my friends here was that it was not so much a comedy, but I believe that it is. And my argument for that is every element, every segment of that film has some sort of comedic element in it. And it's not sort of so much slapstick as it is the entire push of each scene is to be comedic. And so that's my number five.
I mean, I remember even when Arnold Schwarzenegger is killing people, it's pulled off very comically. Like when he escapes from being held captive by that dude who had injected the truth serum in him, he like explains to him how he's going to kill him, and then the guy's just like, "Oh!" And then like he does it and like throws a friggin' thing through the guy's eye. But the whole way that scene plays out
right. Is
like comedic almost, even though it's sort of vicious. So
absolutely,
it's a good call.
Is Jamie Lee Curtis's cleavage a genre?
It should be.
I think so. All right, Brantley, what do you got? Any criteria?
I didn't have too much criteria. I didn't have anything about like they have to have each genre has to have equal weight. Although when I'm looking at my list, I feel like it is pretty balanced in terms of the genres within each film. My number five is Brick, which is kind of it's very much a teen drama as much as it is a neo-noir film. And so that's my number five.
That is a very good pick, and it may come up again on this list. All right, my number five is my only comedy slash. So this is a comedy slash zombie movie. I think you know where I'm going. It is Shaun of the Dead.
Oh, that's a good one.
That is a good one, although I have a another horror comedy on my list that preceded that, which is why it made my list.
Gotcha.
So, and you'll find out what that is in a little bit.
Okay, number four. M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong's Unbreakable.
Ah.
This is both a drama and a comic book movie.
That's a very good movie. That's an underrated movie.
Yeah, absolutely. That's by far his most underrated movie.
People don't give him enough credit for that film, I think. And they give him just the right amount of credit for everything else.
All right, well, my number four is a film I used to own on VHS. And I watched a lot when I was younger. Probably too young, far too young to really realize, the history of the genre, one of the genres within the film. But it is Blackula. And it is a mix of blaxploitation and horror, which we now look at and think of the whole movie as comedy. But I think when it came out, it was really more mixing blaxploitation and horror together.
So you own where did you get that on VHS? Was it just like your dad came home from a business trip with Blackula one day? Like, what? How do you get
you
that?
You are far closer than you think. My dad used to be a part owner in a video store that went out. And so we had boxes of VHS tapes in our, like, garage. And that's where I watched such great films like The Exterminator. I think that's what it was called. It was Lyle Alzado, the former Raiders linebacker who was making a film thing. And he was, like, this horror killer guy in it. But anyway, great box of VHS filled with things like that in it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, my number four already been mentioned. It is Rian Johnston's Brick, which is a teen drama and a neo-noir mixed together. I'm going to say the word neo-noir actually a bunch in this list. So Brick, a movie, if you haven't seen it, you got to check out.
My number three is I forget how to say his name. Alexandro Gonzalez Iñárritu's Beautiful, which got a little bit of attention last year when Javier Bardem was nominated for Best Actor and, in my opinion, should have won Best Actor. Beautiful is, like Iñárritu's other movies, sort of a social drama, but there are fantasy elements to it as well. Bardem's character is sort of gifted with a sort of sixth sense, if you'll excuse the Shyamalan pun. And that's an important, it's not a huge plot element to, in the movie, but it's an important part of his character development. So that's my number three.
That is a movie I really need to check out.
It's quite good. You'll never want to see it again after you see it, though.
It's one of those.
Yep. It's a great movie, though. I recommend it to everybody.
All right. All right, my number three is Ridley Scott's Alien, which is a sci-fi sort of horror house mashup. This was the one that I can see people arguing, no, that's pretty much sci-fi, but just the way that it's done, it feels like one of those movies where everyone's trapped in a house and they can't get out, and essentially that's what Alien is. So I am calling that my number three, and it's obviously a great film.
Sorry, I was just saying that I think when people look back on it now, they think of it as more sci-fi, but when it came out, it was definitely that blend. It was much more prevalent that it was a blend of horror and sci-fi together, and I think because you had so many other sci-fi films kind of mirror that. Like, you have, Pandorum and Event Horizon, which take those horror elements and throw them into the sci-fi as well. I think kind of a public, we've come to think of sci-fi as always having incorporated horror, when really Alien was the first one to really ratchet it up in it.
Good point.
I'll go with my number three, because I think you skipped over me there, Jeremy.
Oh, I did.
Right? I think so. Was it Chapin, me, you? Was that the way we went usually?
Oh yeah, sorry.
That's all right. My number three was Evil Dead 2, which blends the horror and comedy together. Where the first Evil Dead was far more of just a horror film, Evil Dead 2 really brought in the slapstick style humor, especially because Sam Raimi is such a huge Three Stooges fan, and kind of ratcheted it up in that one. So that's my number three.
Well, if Lee was here, he'd say that movie sucks, but I haven't seen it.
So. I'll be Lee. Oh, not again. Blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
All right. So am I number two?
Yep.
Yeah, number two.
Yep.
So this one I'm gonna do because I forgot I've been doing this research and I lost my notes, and I wanted to put this on there and it got vetoed originally, but it's Sleepy Hollow, which, like the last two, or like yours, Brantley, I think brilliantly combines comedy and horror equally. The horror element comes obviously from the story written by, I forget the guy, one of those famous writers. What was that guy's name who wrote Sleepy Hollow? I forget. But that sort of classic horror tale of the guy with the headless horseman. And but then Johnny Depp's character is this sort of hilariously sort of effeminate doctor in, the early, I think it's the 1600s. And he does such a brilliant job at that character, a precursor to Jack Sparrow, of course. And I think it's Tim Burton's best movie.
Interesting. I would go with Ed Wood with that, but no, I do like Sleepy Hollow as well. It is a good film, and also kind of blend some gothic drama in there, I guess, too, if you kind of want to go that route. Although I guess that's really more just the setting of the film rather than the genre. But we'll go right into my number two, which is another Bruce Campbell film, and that is Bubba Ho-Tep, which combines three genres of horror, comedy, and geriatric drama.
Genre, though? Geriatric drama? Are we making
up genres? Old people dramas? Sure.
Right.
Tuesdays with Maury, Cocoon, I guess.
And it's an Elvis movie, too.
And it's an Elvis movie, sure, yeah. So, all kinds of genres going on in there. And I love Bubba Ho-Tep. I have no idea if you've seen it, Jeremy, or you, Chavin, but I love that movie. I think it's brilliant.
So you say you heard a noise?
Yeah, well, I was following the sound, I mean, I heard something. It was like a, scuttling.
Scuttling sound?
Yes, sir.
Were you awake, or were you in bed when you heard this noise?
Well, look, man, I was in bed first, and then I was awake because the damn bugs woke me up, all right? You got bugs all over this place.
Bugs. Well, Mr. Happ, what kind of bugs have you been seeing?
Look, man, do I look like an ichthyologist to you? Big damn bugs, right? The size of my fist, size of a peanut butter banana sandwich, man. What do I care? I got a growth on my picker.
Okay, Mr. Happ, don't worry about a thing. We'll call the exterminator tomorrow, and we'll take care of the problem.
Good, thank you. Thank you very much.
Anyway, so
I remember seeing it and liking it a lot, although I don't remember it very well.
I haven't seen it, so. My number two is another noir movie combined with comedy, and it is The Big Lebowski. A movie we talk about probably a lot here on the podcast because there's really nothing wrong with this film. But I think it really blends those two genres or gives equal weight to those two genres really, really well and integrates them really well. So, I mean, essentially the Coens were trying to do like a Raymond Chandler novel with this, and I think they pulled it off.
Yep, that was on my honorable mentions. So, my number one?
Yes.
Yep.
My number one is Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds.
Or OSS would be my guess.
Ooh, that's a bingo.
Is that the way you say it? That's a bingo?
You just say bingo. Bingo! How fun!
I didn't really know what the other genre was besides a war film, but I don't know, maybe a Tarantino war film. It's a little bit too literal.
Spaghetti Western,
those definitely
maybe?
Are Spaghetti Western. That's very good. Now, I was gonna, you know, you could have gone with Kill Bill here. I mean, that's
any Tarantino,
many
movie.
Many genres.
Yeah,
or a bunch of Tarantino movies. But Inglourious Basterds stood out to me because it was so rooted in that war period and war film sort of setting, and then developed into this Tarantino film within that world. So that's why I chose that one.
Yeah, and you know, it's almost got kind of like, well, I guess what you call kind of a newer genre, which is kind of like a historical reimagining almost, where they're kind of reimagining World War II, Transformers Dark of the Moon reimagined the space land moon landing, X-Men First Class reimagined the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then it's kind of like that's a new genre in literary fiction, and they're kind of taking some of those and putting those into films as well. Like there's going to be a film for Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, as well as Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. So I feel like that's almost like an emerging genre as well.
Right. I don't know what you would call that, the historical exploitation film.
A lot of people would say exactly. JFK counts as that too.
Yeah, you could go with that. Yeah,
that web of lies.
So all right, my number one, Jeremy, you had it on your list. It is Alien. Not much more to say about it. Obviously, kind of one of the first films to really imbue horror into sci-fi. So.
Awesome. And my number one is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Romance and sci-fi combined.
This is the day we met. You were down by the surf. I could just make you out in the distance. I remember being drawn to you even then. I thought, wow, how odd. I'm drawn to someone's back. You were in that orange sweatshirt that I would come to know so well. And even hate eventually. At the time, I thought, how cool. Orange sweatshirt.
Hi there.
Hi.
I saw you sitting over here by yourself. And I thought, thank God, someone normal who doesn't know how to interact with these things either.
Yeah. I don't ever know what to say.
I'm Clementine. Can I... borrow a piece of your chicken.
And it was also my favorite film of the decade. There's not much more I can say about this movie other than it really connected with me, and I can't wait to have another theater experience that like I had with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where I kind of walk out just feeling like, yeah, you know what? I love that movie.
You guys have any honorable mentions?
Okay, let's see, I thought... Yeah, go for it.
Oh, no, I was just going to throw out, like, Blade Runner, sci-fi, noir. But I haven't seen it in like forever, so I kind of felt weird putting it on there. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Although that's kind of more straight up comedy, which is why I didn't put it on there. It just kind of had horror characters in it. And then something like Zombieland, which is a horror comedy road trip movie, kind of a bunch of different ones in there.
I had, Dust Till Dawn, pretty much any Tarantino movie, Blade Runner, Back to the Future 2, Zombieland, and even Never Let Me Go, I really wanted to put on my list, because it's a period piece slash sci-fi film, which is...
Drama.
Yeah, you don't see very often, so I wanted to include that, at least in my honorable mentions.
Yeah, Dark City is one that's like even more extreme than Blade Runner. It's sci-fi and noir absolutely equally. I think it was one of Alex Proyas's first movies. I had The Fifth Element on there. A lot of sci-fi. Cause that's the problem with this list for me was that, like, you know, the sci-fi setting is very easy to have, and then you've got to have another element, though. I mean, what is a sci-fi plot? I mean, I guess there's aliens and set in space, but then what happens, you know? Like, so I had a lot of sci-fi on there that I tried to keep off.
Gotcha.
Although Alien is a great pick, guys. I do have to echo that.
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We want to thank Chapin for coming on and filling in for Lee on the podcast today. We want to encourage all of our listeners to check out the podcast that he does, Exterior Films Podcast. You can find that on iTunes. Just search Exterior Films, and it'll come up. And then we want to encourage everybody to go to the GetYourFilmFix.com website. Check out all the articles we do. We put our podcasts up on there. We have videos and everything you can check out. And there's a donate tab if you want to help us out, to help us continue doing what we're doing. The podcast, videos, articles, any donation you make, no matter how big or small, really helps us out. And also, if you'd like to go to iTunes, you can rate us or write a review. We always appreciate any feedback we get. So thanks, everybody, for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.